This is The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York, Queens College. Today, we discuss Amazon H2Q and New York City. Our discussants include Sharon Zukin from the City University of New York, Brooklyn College, and Miriam Greenberg from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Our discussion was recorded on Wednesday, February 27th, 2019. So over the past few weeks, New York has been on a roller coaster related to Amazon's plans to develop a second headquarters here. And the event opened up a lot of discussion about the role of tech in development and what cities should be expecting of the businesses that set up shop locally. And those discussions culminated in Amazon's withdrawal from its plans to open up in New York, which came as a shock to a lot of the city. And I thought, you know, what better way to process this than to bring on two of our discipline's leading urban sociologists. First, we'll start with Sharon Zukin, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the Graduate Center in the City University of New York. Sharon wrote the seminal Loft Living. That's a seminal work in urban sociology. And you have a new book in the works, Sharon?
Yes, indeed. I have a book on New York's tech economy, which will be published next year in 2020.
Wonderful. And Miriam Greenberg is a professor of sociology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. And she wrote the seminal work on city branding, Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World with Rutledge. And also Crisis Cities, Disaster and Redevelopment in New York and New Orleans with Oxford University Press. And Miriam, you have a new edited volume out with Cornell.
That's right. Yes. It's called The City is the Factory, New Solidarities and Spatial Strategies in an Urban Age, co-edited with Penny Lewis.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you both for joining us for this roundtable. I thought we'd start things off maybe by just giving those of us who haven't been following this story, you know, a primer on this. What is H2Q? What did Amazon want to do and what was it looking for? Why were cities so anxious to be part of these HQ2 plans? Who wants to start off?
Well, I can start with this. In the fall of 2017, Amazon announced a competition for cities, towns, and localities of every stripe throughout North America. The company was going to create a second headquarters. Presumably, it would be co-equal with the company's first headquarters in Seattle. But there would be, most crucially, about 25,000 jobs that would be needed in whatever city was fortunate enough to get this headquarters, and a kind of Olympics competition of city governments then took place, where every local government tried their utmost to throw the javelin farthest and snowboard the fastest to give Amazon the very most accurate picture of what the city's economy and living conditions and transportation and communications network were all about, and most crucially, what local government would do to tempt Amazon to come into their surroundings.
I think that Sharon did a really great job of summarizing that. I think it might have been 50,000 jobs, and then they divided it up between the two cities in the end, but
right, I can never remember.
Yeah.
Yes,
but otherwise, yeah, I think that that's right. Whether we call it the Olympics or the Hunger Games, it's maybe a debatable question.
What were cities doing to induce Amazon to come? What were they offering?
Well, first you have to understand that this is the normal situation in the United States and Europe. at least since the 1970s, this kind of, maybe even back to the 1950s, this kind of jockeying for the favor of companies has gone on. You know, we like to think that in the early days of industrial capitalism, companies just located where there was a river where water for steam power could be water could be used to generate steam power. But you know, at least since the 1960s, companies have been able to play a game of geographical dominoes and get local governments to ante up all kinds of benefits. And this competition resulted in the beggaring, in the impoverishment of many cities that did everything they could to lure or to keep factories. For decades, this has been going on. Amazon did everybody a favor by drawing back the curtain and showing that this process is pervasive.
So this isn't a new thing. This is just, it was just highly publicized and was one of the ones to so forcefully enter our collective consciousness.
Yes.
You know, one reason was the enormous publicity that Amazon was able to generate simply because it's such a big and highly valued, that is in the financial sense, highly valued and expanding company. Walmart did something like this from the 1980s on, where Walmart would tell a local government that they wanted to open up, and then they would tell the local government in the next county that they wanted to open up, and they would try to get these local governments to build highway exits for them or to give them some kind of tax benefits. So, and in return for a certain number of jobs that the company never went so far as to promise, but suggested that they would create.
I think that that's totally spot on. I think, you know, it's been around. Sometimes it was referred to as smokestack chasing. Currently, it's often referred to as skyscraper chasing because it's going after, you know, headquarters and so forth. But this kind of interurban competition for the location of companies and with them promises of economic development of jobs has been going on for decades. I think that in the 70s and 80s, the process, you could say, intensified and became more generalized across all kinds of different cities alongside of federal retrenchment in support of cities, in support of things like Sharon's talking about in terms of infrastructure, such that, you know, so there was a process of kind of a simultaneous retrenchment of the federal government from support of cities, whether it was infrastructure, housing, education, and all kinds of other things that cities had to cover fiscally. And in addition, deindustrialization and the loss of the tax base from industry. And so there became this intensification, there arose an intensification of competition between cities and, you know, this kind of attempt to position and market yourself for the location of headquarters, as well as for other forms of investment, tourism, new sources of revenue, the location of a new middle class, the creative class, and so forth, in an effort to recoup some of that lost revenue and maintain basic budgets for cities.
Miriam is exactly right. And let me add that the geographical scale of both deindustrialization and competition for new jobs was a global scale because of increasingly global investments, so that you had cities, say, in France and Belgium that were competing for a steel plant that could have well been built in either place. You had American companies that were investing in production capacity in Asia, in Latin America. You know, there was not just a structural pressure and an institutional pressure to find new sources of job creation. But there was a global scale to all of this that really made the competition intense.
So what it sounds like this type of stuff was typical. Was there anything particularly notable or remarkable about the Amazon search? Like, was there any sort of new information that you got or any aspect of this search that changed your impressions either about, you know, these dog and pony shows or, you know, the role of tech or headquarter placement, any of that?
Well, there was the tech overlay that was new, and so that the romance and the fantasy of high tech growth was spread by the Amazon competition, and then again the openness of the situation, which could be described as either incredible brass effrontery, or just an acknowledgement that big business was super powerful. Hmm. So the very openness of soliciting bids from local governments was new. This was, you know, again, these competitive processes had been played out pretty much behind a curtain so that most people were unaware of them. But I'll tell you something interesting. The building of the new postgraduate engineering school in New York, Cornell Tech, took place after a similar international competition that New York City ran in 2010 and 2011. It wasn't exactly the same as a for-profit company running a competition between local governments. But in the case of the postgraduate engineering school that has wound up as Cornell Tech in New York City, the New York City government announced a competition for universities that would agree to set up a specialized training program in business and computer engineering that would build the entrepreneurial part of the tech workforce in New York City. The winning bid would get $100 million in various kinds of expenditures by New York City and a lot of infrastructure help. So it wasn't exactly the same kind of competition, but it was a big and open competition among universities to open in a school in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that Sharon mentioned earlier the Olympics and clearly the competition that cities around the world undergo for the Olympics is something that's very public. And I think these kinds of competitions have served to kind of normalize this practice such that it strikes everyday, you know, New Yorkers often or urban citizens, like this is the way economic development happens, that, you know, this is kind of, there is no alternative to this approach. That's one thing maybe we can talk a bit about more later. But I think, in addition, I think cities perhaps after the fact, you know, like, or cities and states, like in the case of Wisconsin, with Foxconn and so forth, make a big deal about having won these contracts, even while touting the promises that the corporations are making in terms of jobs and other forms of development, even while the process leading up to that moment has been behind closed doors. So it's not as though the public isn't familiar with this kind of a process. I do think, I agree with Sharon that Amazon, in a sense, did a service in just sort of exposing, you know, the degree to which cities have to play this game on such a scale, and I think the kind of the zero sum nature of it, the idea that, you know, it's winner take all kind of a situation for cities, and this kind of scramble and the desperation really that many cities are in to attract jobs and development at this moment was exposed in a big way.
To continue with what Miriam was just saying, it's funny that the desire to have political leaders create jobs is a perverse triumph of Keynesianism, maybe one of the unquestioned results of Keynesianism these days, where we expect government somehow to create jobs, yet it's the corporations that governments kowtow to for the jobs.
And does, I get the sense, does the scheme pay off? Does it work for, I mean, New York is a unique case. Does the scheme in general work?
We don't have a counterexample yet. I think with Amazon's withdrawal from New York's from the recent situation in New York City, we do have a test case where we can see in an admittedly atypical city whether economic development can be generated or can be sustained without giving these kinds of subsidies. We like to think that the tech economy in New York has emerged without subsidies, and much is made of the fact that Google is now in the process of doubling its workforce and the number of office buildings that it occupies without government subsidies. Facebook, Infor, IBM Watson, all of the tech companies that are active in New York City, they most of them have not got subsidies. Amazon, actually, which has about 5,000 employees in New York in different kinds of commerce, as well as in marketing and advertising, they have received already city subsidies to create jobs, though not on the scale of the recent subsidies that the state contributed to. So we really have to take a closer look to see whether the tech economy has been created with subsidies or without subsidies, and what kinds of subsidies those have been. What I think many people would not object to is the fact that New York City does subsidize a lot of tech development, not only through Cornell Tech, but through a number of incubators and accelerators that New York City helps to support financially in partnership with different private organizations and venture capitalists. And maybe the feeling is that these subsidies go to homegrown and small-scale startups. They don't go to a tech giant. So I think this was one particularly galling factor about the subsidies, that it was a tech titan that was going to get a really gigantic payout.
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of the sense of, you know, the injustice as well as the unnecessary nature of these subsidies. You know, this idea that, you know, who was really benefiting from locating in New York, which has this incredible infrastructure, you know, needs help with its infrastructure, but certainly already has existing infrastructure and knowledge base and workforce and, you know, incredibly, you know, educated populace and so forth. So Amazon is coming to a city that already has this great, you know, ecosystem of tech industries and so forth. And Amazon is going to benefit enormously from locating there, and clearly would chose to do so, and as many people are arguing, would have chosen to do so without the subsidies. But it is in such a powerful position that it can exact these kinds of subsidies. And I think in terms of your earlier question about how effective subsidies are in general, you know, there's a lot of research that shows a pretty abysmal record in terms of job production associated with subsidies. One of the organizations that I became connected to actually when I was doing the project on crisis cities, because it had to do with issues of redevelopment and efforts to invest in order to produce jobs at that moment after 9/11, was Good Jobs New York, which is connected to Good Jobs First, a national organization that actually has a subsidy tracker. And really is done an enormous service, I think, for us in tracking the success rate or lack thereof of subsidies. And I would encourage folks to check that out, and has produced a lot of a lot of reports on this issue. But again, as a result of the kind of lack of transparency often associated with these deals, which is one of the foci of Good Jobs First and other kind of good government groups that try to uncover these deals. As a result of the lack of transparency, we often don't even know what was being promised in the first place, what the kind of ability of these companies to get out of deals is as well. And so there's often a lot of flexibility. There's a lot of risk on the city side, but not a lot of risk on the company side when they take these subsidies.
Did you take it as meaningful that they chose New York and DC? I remember the first reactions of journalists out in the Midwest was, bemoaning the fact that Amazon chose a place where taxes are high and cost of living is high. And despite many of the financial disadvantages, they still came here. Like, I'm sure Kansas City or Minneapolis would have written Amazon a blank check for those 50,000 jobs. Did you treat that as a sort of a data point about the relative power of cities, the fact that Amazon ultimately chose New York and DC?
As Miriam said before, New York is in fact North America's largest city. And there is a weight of the city that pulls companies in. There is a highly educated workforce and an enlarging tech workforce here, although arguably that workforce is not big enough to fill all the tech jobs that are coming down the pike.
That's true. Yes. And so the question of where the people would be coming from to fill the jobs is a good one. Yeah.
But I mean, if you couldn't fill them in New York, how could you fill them in Kansas City? How could you fill them in?
Well, yes, but that's an interesting point, because we just don't know how many of the Amazon jobs or how many tech jobs in general are filled by people who move to New York to take those jobs, right, whether they are already Amazon employees or they come here from other parts of the U.S. or other regions of the world to fill these jobs. That's a question. I mean, there was a question. Maybe it wasn't the biggest question, but it was a question asked during the past couple of months. How many of Amazon's well-paying tech jobs would be filled by what we call native New Yorkers? And that just means people who generally are educated in the city's universities or the city's high schools and live in the city already.
Hmm. Right. And that was something that Mario Amazon Cuomo, as he dubbed right. himself, was not willing to answer.
It was Andrew Amazon Cuomo.
Right. I'm sorry. Oh, that's such a funny mistake.
Yes.
Andrew Amazon Cuomo was not, perhaps not so dissimilar to his father in this regard, but was not willing, or had not within the negotiations with Amazon, made that a stipulation, so when people were posing that question, there was a kind of an interview with him on the Brian Lehrer show that I was reading about where, he starts out sort of saying, we're going to be attracting all of these workers to New York. And then at the end he says, well, it could be me, it could be you, Brian, we could get these jobs. But it was clearly not something that was stipulated in the negotiations. Mm. And that was an issue for a lot of folks. But I think that that you often see with these competitions that a small subset of cities end up winning over and again, particularly when they're on this kind of a scale. And it has to do, as Sharon was saying, with the desire of the CEO. It has to do often with the upper management and even middle management. Where would they want to live? Where is the quality of life considered to be the best, and so forth? And there, it becomes this kind of snowball effect. As more companies locate in places and as they play a role in reshaping the built environment and the quality of life of a city and the culture of a city, it attracts other companies to come. And this is, something that in urban sociology, folks have been looking at for quite a while in terms of, you know, the notion that we live in this global age in which people don't need to be kind of co-located and don't need to have face-to-face interactions and don't need to be place-based any longer because of technology and transportation and so forth is true to a degree, but clearly people want to be in a very active, vibrant hub, one that also happens to be hip and cool in all kinds of ways. And so for their workforce, insofar as they're at the upper level of the workforce and have some choice in the matter. And so I think that New York has been one of those winners since it kind of rebranded itself after the 70s.
Well, I would make that even a narrower window and say that since New York rebranded itself as friendly to tech and then leading in tech after 2010, the city began to attract more and more people who work in what they call tech and creative firms and who want to start those kinds of businesses. It's not just jobs that hit the sweet spot in New York City as far as the Amazon deal was concerned, but it was transportation and housing, two other parts of what Miriam referred to as the built environment, that were not the sweet spot, but maybe the sour spot of the deal. The Amazon subsidies were proposed at the very same time that the subway system in New York is experiencing more than its usual share of breakdowns and other issues. The subway system has a real need for a cash infusion to pay for the modernization that a transportation system that is more than 100 years old really does need. The crisis of affordable housing, which New York and many other cities of the world experience, is so acute that the impact of a horde of potentially well-paid job holders descending on one of the boroughs of the city and buying apartments was really more than a lot of people could bear to think about. So this was an amazingly bad moment for a deal to be offered to a big company that would seem to impoverish not only other cities, but impoverish New Yorkers, crazily enough, in the face of the jobs that were dangled in our eyes.
That's interesting. What exactly were the qualms that people had about the Amazon relocation? Like, can you sort of flesh out what people were concerned about after this announcement was made?
Yeah, well, I think that what Sharon was saying is really important. So, you know, it's and to your earlier question about why this deal was different and went in a different direction, I think we are at a moment of a recognition of a crisis in transportation, in housing, in inequality that's really concentrated in cities and in cities like New York. And that has, and you know, New York has a long history of, since its inception, really, of this kind of dual, it's kind of been a dual city of, on the one hand, organizing and real grassroots and working class consciousness and organizing that also made claim to what we now often refer to as a kind of right to the city, and that neighborhoods and working class people and working people more generally have a right to have a say in the future and path of development that their city is going to take. And on the other hand, this, you know, center of Wall Street and of global capitalism. And so it's there's been this long experience of kind of dealing with these kinds of contradictions. I think that this moment, for a lot of reasons with what's going on nationally, you know, in terms of the Trump presidency, the role of huge corporations like Amazon and taking over entire sectors and not having any kind of monopoly checks and balances to that, and you know, putting out of business all kinds of brick and mortar mom and pop stores and so forth at the lower end as a result of their taking over of so many markets. Their anti-union, explicit anti-union policies.
That's right.
Which we could talk more about. Their impact in Seattle and the precedent of their impact in Seattle, which organizers in Seattle came to coordinate with organizers in New York to discuss. Their resistance to any kind of regulation by the city council in Seattle to pay any kind of tax to compensate for the impact that they were having in terms of gentrification and displacement, which was massive in Seattle. All of those things kind of really fed into what was already this growing discontent, arguably, you know, kind of spearheaded in the current era during the Occupy Wall Street, mobilizing, but also had been developing in all kinds of ways in stuff that I've looked at since, you know, 9/11 and the redevelopment after 9/11, since, post Sandy organizing and so forth. All of these waves of kind of disasters that set in their wake increased gentrification and displacement to really crystallize in a pretty clear-headed opposition to this particular deal, which was on such a scale and was going to have such an outsized impact on this community, which had already suffered so much. That it really amplified these issues in a big way. So, and I think one final thing I would just say is, you know, there were symbolic elements to this. So Sharon was talking about the lack of investment in infrastructure and transportation and the cost that this was going to that was going to be borne by having 25,000 workers coming in to this area that was already heavily underserviced. And as a result of which, Jeff Bezos was going to build his own personal helipad, which the city was going to subsidize.
Yeah.
You know, just really, again, the scale of this deal, and then the kind of role of CEOs like Bezos and their demands, just pushed it to a point of really enabling people to counter what has become this common sense, this kind of hegemonic idea about how economic development has to take place and who has to suffer from it.
Miriam is exactly right. Some of the reports that have come out in the past week or two since the Valentine's Day massacre, or at least the withdrawal on February 14th of Amazon from dealing with New York City, at least over the recent offer. One of the turning points was, in fact, at one of the two city council hearings after the deal had been struck, where Amazon representatives said they would not be neutral if their employees in New York wanted to form a labor union. Not be neutral means they would oppose their workers forming a union or joining a union, and that was one of the turning points in the process, where many New Yorkers said this is totally irrational in a global situation where traditional labor unions continue to lose members and alternative workers' organizations are being formed. A company that says they will not be receptive to labor organizing is a company that we don't want here. Another policy, or I should say another turning point, I think, on the side of Amazon was the company's realization that the opposition to this deal in New York opened the door to criticism of many of the company's business practices, such as selling facial recognition software to the government, collaborating with the immigration authorities. contracts with the military, maybe things that other tech companies also do, but Amazon really exposed itself to criticism across the board, and they didn't want that.
So when you walk away from this whole story, what are the big take homes for each of you? Like what are the big lessons that you learned throughout this whole process?
Well, number one, there has to be a much more participation in economic development decisions. I think that that's already a movement that's underway in New York City and in other localities.
Yes, and I think this is in for many people who've been involved in those kinds of efforts, a pretty exciting moment, really. I think, you know, one of the things that I talked about in Branding New York way back in the day about and in thinking about reflecting on the impact of this shift that New York was at the center of in the late 70s and early 80s with branding itself and trying to market itself for corporate relocations such as these and becoming really kind of winning the battle at that moment was which also I should say involved this kind of restructuring of the city and this neoliberalized restructuring, which involved cuts, austerity cuts to the public sector and so forth, as well as forms of regulating labor. People said, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York. You know, they would sing the New York, New York song, and New York came to symbolize this shift. Like if New York could restructure itself and rebrand itself away from its very radical pro-labor past and become the center for corporate America in this way. And Ronald Reagan was one of the people who spoke about this in the early 80s. Any city could do this. And I think we're seeing a similar kind of symbolic role played by New York in countering the Amazon HQ2. And cities are realizing like they don't have to take these terrible deals. They can resist. Communities have a pretty remarkable strength. And, you know, so the community organizations like, you know, Make the Road and Good Jobs New York and others who came together to, as well as, you know, local council members and so forth in these districts to counter this actually won the day against one of the world's largest corporations and the world's wealthiest man. And so there's a sense like, you know, actually this kind of organizing can be effective, particularly if it's done in concert with other cities. And so one of the things that I'm kind of excited by is that we're starting to see this idea that there needs to actually be solidarity, not only amongst workers, but amongst cities to resist this kind of, you know, beggaring, this kind of winner take all, zero sum game struggle for economic development. And there needs to be a new conversation about how economic development needs to take place in cities and at, you know, larger scales in this country. Such that cities aren't positioned in this kind of a way, and local communities and neighborhoods like Long Island City aren't positioned in this kind of desperate way. So I feel like this is a kind of watershed moment in that regard.
Miriam is right. I think that the existing organizations of mayors of different cities and activist organizations in different cities now have a clear charter to follow to make sure that the conditions within different cities offer a level playing field. What I hope will come about is this kind of alliance between cities that Miriam suggests, and a standing together for the interests of all the citizens.
Sharon Zukin is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. Miriam Greenberg is a professor of sociology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit us on the web, www.sociocast.org/annex. Follow us on Twitter @SociAnnex and visit us on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Sharon Zukin and Miriam Greenberg, I'm Joseph Cohen. Thanks for listening.